This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Carlson Fish Oils. Fish oil provides the vital omega-3s, EPA and DHA, which support cardiovascular, brain and nerve, vision, immune system, joint, and skin health. Carlson ensures maximum freshness by managing their fish oils from sea to shelf. All Carlson fish oils are tested by an FDA-registered laboratory for freshness, potency, and purity, and they're available in soft gels and liquid form. For more information, go to carlsonlabs.com. Carlson fish oils are available at fine health food stores nationwide. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. And today we're going to try something completely different. Usually we interview guests or we do clinical-focused podcasts. But we're going to institute something over the summer, which I would term a weekly update. And it involves stories that end up on the cutting room floor from my weekend broadcast. My weekend broadcast, of course, heard on syndicated radio. And you can listen to it via handy link on the live stream. Or you can also hear it on Mondays when we put up that program, along with notes showing references to the stories that we talk about. But because of time limitations, we don't get to all the stories that we want to cover. So I want to institute a weekly update where we'll share with you from time to time stories that never made it to the broadcast. So here goes. I want to start with a report from the Boston Globe entitled "Whistleblower Files Suit Over Alleged Double-Booked Surgeries." And this has to do with Massachusetts General Hospital. That, by many standards, is considered the top hospital in the United States. I recently took a trip to Boston. Toured Massachusetts General Hospital. It's very fascinating because you can actually go into rooms there that are some of the oldest operating theaters in the United States, old-fashioned operating theaters like you see in the movies with grandstand seats. And then down in the pit is the actual operatory where they used to operate on patients in the very first days when they first were discovering things like anesthesia. So it's quite fascinating historically. It's grown into an amazing hospital, highest standard of care in the world. But this is a scandal that is circling around Massachusetts General Hospital. It has to do with what happens to you when you undergo surgery. Quite pertinent because once you go in there and you're sedated and knocked out, you don't have too much of a purview over what's transpiring in there. And that's what this story has to do with. The fact that surgeons sometimes double book surgeries so that they literally have to be in two places at once. Okay? And it's more lucrative that way. Some may say it's more efficient. Some may say, in defense of this practice, that there are very capable fellows who are doctors in training, who follow the chief surgeon around and could do kind of the routine work, maybe open up the patient, close up the patient. And I've seen it done when I went through my surgical rotations, is the finesse part of the operation is often done by the chief surgeon with many years of experience. But the routine stuff like stitching up the patient or making the initial incisions to open things up is done by a fellow. So the story from the Boston Globe: orthopedic surgeons at Massachusetts General Hospital repeatedly kept patients waiting under anesthesia longer, sometimes more than an hour longer, than was medically necessary or safe as they juggled two or even three simultaneous operations, according to a federal lawsuit that alleges frequent billing fraud at the prestigious hospital. Now, the suit involves a whistleblower. She was an anesthesiologist. In other words, she wasn't a surgeon, but she got to witness what the surgeons were up to. Dr. Lisa Wollman, And presumably she's not a very popular person around Mass General Hospital these days because she's blown a whistle on some very prominent doctors. She alleges that the doctors defrauded the government by submitting bills for surgeries in which they were not in the operating room for critical portions of procedures, leaving the work to unsupervised trainees, who, by the way, make a pittance in terms of salary. She, Dr. Wellman, said she witnessed surgeons performing simultaneous operations repeatedly, this caused her to leave in disgruntled fashion from Massachusetts General Hospital for another hospital. She said that hospital policy was such that it provided perverse incentives for doctors to do more and more and more procedures, to bill more, to make more money for themselves in the hospital. And they never told patients that they'd be going back and forth between operating rooms, so there was no full disclosure. And this meant that an unwitting patient was left fully anesthetized, unconscious, paralyzed, intubated for longer than medically necessary. And they cite the case of, here's a case of, in the story, on the morning of October, one morning in October 2011, the suit said a 65-year-old patient on blood pressure meds waited under anesthesia for a full 90 minutes before a surgeon identified only as Surgeon A arrived from another operating room to start the patient's surgery. It's like, you know, they're standing around, and this has got to be very frustrating for the people supporting the surgery, the anesthesiologist and the nurses. Just they're standing around waiting. Where's the surgeon? Well, he's off in another operating room operating on another patient. And maybe, you know, he ran into some trouble, took him a little longer. So he comes rushing in 90 minutes late. He then arrived from another operating room to start the patient's surgery. The suit said Surgeon A had scheduled the two long shoulder operations to start within 15 minutes of each other. So, you know, a rather cynical attempt to garner two fees, because you can't do a shoulder operation in 15 minutes. But he figured, hey, we'll start one 15 minutes later. I'll get there eventually. You just wait for me. Keep the patient, under. And that's not good for the patients. And also, it is a deceptive practice. There's no disclosure. In defense of his care, one of these hotshot doctors, a guy specializing in shoulder surgery, a Dr. Warner, said, the suggestion that I'm not managing all my patients' care while they're in the operating room is both untrue and malicious. He said he always performs the key components of surgery and that fellows occasionally do, quote, non-critical activities such as positioning and making the initial incision. Well, you know, I've witnessed it, you know, more than 30 years ago. I know they do a lot more. At any rate, this should alert you. You know, question your surgeon, question your anesthesiologist, because you don't want any shenanigans going on that may put you at risk, because prolonged periods of time under anesthesia could be hazardous, as we've seen, you know, with the Joan Rivers case, but also, unnecessarily debilitating, because you may wake up extraordinarily groggy. Your recovery time may be impaired because being under anesthesia for a long period of time is no picnic. Enough said. All right, you've heard of the Twinkie defense. That was in the case of a San Francisco supervisor who was killed. He was a well-known gay supervisor on the San Francisco City Council. Became a hero of the gay rights movement, but his assassin invoked the Twinkie defense, claiming that his blood sugar was out of kilter, and that that's what actually provoked him to be so irritable as to kill this guy. Well, now we have the Celexa defense. Celexa made me do it, says the attorney to Michelle Carter, a 20-year-old who was recently convicted of involuntary manslaughter. Very unique case, because it was a Facebook killing. In a series of posts on Facebook, messaging back and forth, Michelle Carter, 20 years old, convinced, at the time, she's 20 years old at the time of the trial, but she was 17 at the time this event took place. She cajoled her then boyfriend, Conrad Roy, who was 18, to commit suicide by carbon monoxide poisoning. Apparently he was in a car in a garage, and he killed himself by means of asphyxiation. And so, and I didn't know this until the end of the trial, but there's an interesting wrinkle to this. I mean, first of all, it's unique, the idea that you can kill someone remotely. Okay, I mean, involuntary manslaughter might be, I don't know, you get in a fight and perhaps, you know, a fit of anger, you know, you stab someone, okay? I mean, it's not like premeditated killing. But here it is alleged, and actually she was convicted on this basis, that in fact there's a trail of evidence that she diabolically kept him focused on his goal to commit suicide. Finally, she just said, you know, get it over with. You know, do it, do it, do it. And he did, and he was dead. So, but the interesting wrinkle to this is that she was on an antidepressant called Celexa, which is kind of a newer form of, you know, Prozac-style medications. It's an SNRI as opposed to Prozac, which is an SSRI. Pretty popular medication, possibly one of the most popular antidepressant medications around. And there's a lot of concern about the use of these medications in kids because kids have different brains than adults. I mean, there's concern about adults taking these medications, but kids have different brains. And actually, some of these medications have been implicated in killings. It may be that some of the shooters involved in mass shootings were taking these medications. And it's one theory that these medications remove restraint, that they can turn you from someone who is merely depressed into a stone-cold killer without any kind of restraint or compunctions about your actions. And that is the allegation that was leveled in defense of Ms. Carter, unsuccessfully, apparently. They brought in Dr. Peter Breggin. Now, if that name sounds familiar, he wrote a book entitled Prozac Backlash, which was a critique of Prozac and talked about how a lot of people get into serious trouble when they cold turkey on that type of medication. It's actually a very useful book. It's amazing that these medications were out for many years, and it took this professor at Harvard, psychiatrist Peter Breggin, finally call to the public's attention, the medical establishment's attention, the fact that you just can't cold turkey on these medications, that you can have devastating withdrawal side effects, and that you have to be very carefully tapered. So the book Prozac Backlash, classic, I think it might have come out, you know, in the late 90s, early 2000s, quite a long time ago. So he's well known for being an expert on side effects of these medications. He was brought in to testify, and he says, and this is an important legal point, that when Ms. Carter, at the age of 17, was taking Celexa, she was not able to form criminal intent. Okay? In other words, it's actually like a form of guilty or innocent by reason of insanity, is that it's beyond your control. Your actions are actually not within your purview. He says medications such as Celexa can, he explained, can impair love, understanding, wisdom, and judgment. Wow, that's pretty amazing, because like how many millions of people out there are on Celexa? And some of them might be involved in murderous, homicidal actions. Breggin asserted that Conrad was talking to an emotionally troubled younger girl about his plans to take his own life. And at first, She tried to dissuade him from committing suicide. Finally, it's almost like she got kind of like bored and frustrated. She says, look, I mean, I've been talking to you for hours. You're not doing anything about it. Just get on with it. You know, Roy, the female, told Carter that, quote, it was his time to go and that Satan wanted him in hell on a specific date. She told him that he was scaring her and to stop. So, wow. She had actually tried to dissuade him from committing suicide. But the prosecution alleged that Carter was duplicitous, that she was two-faced. She feigned the role of being a loving and distraught girlfriend, but then ultimately cajoled her boyfriend towards suicide. She sent him, according to the article I'm reading here, it's called Blasting News, but it's a good article by Ann Cox, one of their journalists, she sent him a litany of messages encouraging him to kill himself. And conviction was upheld. She faces up to 20 years in prison now that she's been convicted of involuntary manslaughter. The Celexa defense didn't work, but it's a cautionary tale because, especially when it comes to adolescents who are a little bit different in brain structure. Most of these medications were tested out on adults, in fact, highly skewed towards males in the tests when the majority of people taking them just statistically are females. So, you know, the question is, how could these medications go awry in people with unique brain characteristics? And the answer is quite possibly. However, the court saw fit to ignore that particular perspective in its judgment. Okay, this is something that I could have predicted a long time ago. When Zika hysteria first began to take hold, not that Zika is not a clear and present danger. It is not invariably going to cause severe illness. Rarely in non-pregnant individuals, even males, it can cause very serious problems like a form of paralysis, a Guillain-Barré-like illness that's very devastating. But some patients get bitten by Zika-carrying mosquitoes and are asymptomatic, or they have very mild disease that's self-limited that passes, and some people are completely unaware of it. Unfortunately, in mothers who are pregnant, about 10% of them, the offspring experience brain changes, which can include microcephaly, like a small head and a small brain, profound mental retardation, very devastating birth defect. But at the time, I was waving the caution flag about the widespread spraying and mosquito treatments that were undertaken because of the hysteria that was generated by Zika. And the concern was that Zika would reach the mainland. In fact, there were reports of Zika-carrying mosquitoes, although there was very little in the way of evidence that Zika was being transmitted in the United States. The vast majority of individuals who came down with Zika were Americans who were traveling to tourist destinations in the Caribbean, who acquired the virus by being bitten by mosquitoes while in tropical areas. Nonetheless, we didn't want to have anything to do with Zika, and so a very aggressive public health campaign was undertaken across certain parts of Florida, in particular Manatee County, which comprises some of the main tourist areas, highly populated areas of Florida. And so what they discovered, based on a study done in China, the study, they say here, this is from a Florida paper, the Bradenton Herald, recent story. The study was undertaken in China, and it's the first to examine real-world exposure to a insecticide called NALED, N-A-L-E-D. The study is the first to examine real-world exposure to NALED outside workplace accidents or lab experiments. It used cord blood from 237 mothers who gave birth to healthy babies at a hospital in southeast China between 2008 and 2011. This is before Zika was raised its ugly head, but nonetheless, NALED has been in use for a long time. At 6 weeks, the babies displayed no problems, but at 9 months, the babies suffered from slight problems with coordination, movement, and other motor functions. The study was published in a journal called Environment International a couple of weeks ago. And so, health officials in Manatee County say that indeed they've used NALED. And in fact, in September of 2016, there was already concern about this. Over 100 protesters demonstrated on the steps of Miami Beach City Hall against the use of the pesticide NALED being sprayed in Miami Beach to combat Zika. Okay? So they show these demonstrators here in a picture. Zika is bad. NALED is a neurotoxic poison. And you think, well, these are a bunch of, you know, nutcase, overzealous citizens who are protesting against a sound public health measure because Zika is a terrible scourge, and they're not worried about Zika. They're worried about NALED. One sign says Zika is bad. NALED is a neurotoxic poison. So it's kind of like, you know, in an effort to combat a real but somewhat hypothetical problem, we have created another problem by exposing people on a mass basis and an involuntary basis too, because this is not like a vaccine thing where you can refuse. This is, you know, you're in a community and helicopters are spraying this over your head. And I've seen this here in New York City. I remember a few years back when West Nile was the scourge du jour. You know, every few years there's a scourge, you know, like some doomsday scourge. And I remember walking home from work. I used to do my broadcast near Times Square at the WR Studios when they were located there at 1440 Broadway. And I would walk home, a mile back to my apartment late at night. It was quite nice because, you know, the streets were empty and, you know, it'd be 12 o'clock at night. And it was kind of a pleasant way to wind down from doing a radio program. And I remember one summer night, there was these big trucks going down Fifth Avenue. The streets were empty and they were spraying this stuff. It was like, what in the heck are they doing? There was a brouhaha then about the potential exposure to toxic pesticides too. But, you know, the public health perspective prevailed, and they ended up spraying the streets in an effort to curtail a possible epidemic of West Nile disease. So now there is a little bit of controversy about this because the manufacturer of NALED says they're not sure how the Chinese got exposed to NALED. A spokesman for AMVAC, the U.S. manufacturer of the pesticide NALED, said the company has no record of selling NALED in China, so they were puzzled by the findings and said the U.S. government has approved its use for mosquito control for 5 decades. In other words, they say, nothing to see here, perfectly safe, and besides, quote, we do not sell NALED into China, and we have no idea how it may have been used or how much is applied. We cannot verify the validity of the China study, knowing nothing about the source of the product or how the population was selected. We recommend a measured science-based reaction to the study and look forward to its broader evaluation and peer review. So, although the Chinese are very well known for knocking stuff off, you know, for industrial espionage and for copying products that are developed in the United States and elsewhere. And it could be that the Chinese made their own batch of NALED. The question is whether it was a tainted batch of NALED, because we do have concerns about Chinese manufacturing standards and the potential for them to go awry. But it's a study that's pretty concerning, because researchers used a standard motor skill test that looks at reflexes, body control, movement, and hand and eye coordination. And as exposure to NALED increased, they found the defects also rose. So, here it is. We got to balance our concern over potential hazards like NALED versus, real concerns over whether there's going to be some toxic burden to the environment, or potentially hazardous exposure to people, and especially children, who we know are more vulnerable to neurological consequences of exposure, and especially pregnant women, because that's a critical time for neurological development. So, it's a bad situation. Stuck between a rock and a hard place. On the one hand, we don't want pregnant moms to get bitten by Zika-carrying mosquitoes, because that could be potentially devastating. It's a Russian roulette. 1 out of 10 have serious problems. On the other hand, do we want to expose thousands and possibly millions of people to uncertain hazards from widespread pesticide and insecticide dispersal through the environment, especially when there's no choice? It's an involuntary thing. A decision is made by government in the guise of public health to safeguard people, and in so doing, they might inadvertently expose people to more danger. Okay, our listeners know that we divide these podcasts into two parts, so stay with us, because we'll return with a second installment of update on the news of the week here on this podcast of Intelligent Medicine. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. We'll be right back.